Was there ever such a time? Then suddenly it's done. The moment passes. Where does the time go? Must we let it end? Where does the time go? Gone too soon, my friend. And where go the echoes of our laughter ringing the air? Oh, wherever the time goes, I will see you there.
The time is almost up. Thanks for listening to Big Band Broadway and Beyond. God bless, and if anybody asks, tell them Joe sent you.
Must we let it end? And where go the echoes of our laughter ringing the air?
This is WHFR Dearborn, and now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to a special summer entertainment edition of the new WHFR Journal for July 1st, 2011. Hope you're all having so far first day of sort of a extended holiday weekend celebrating the Declaration of Independence, the first time that we said we're going to be free from foreign domination, except we were all pretty much Englishmen anyway, so we're just sort of separating from foreign domination, not necessarily from our heritage. In any event, July 4th, 1776 is the famous date. And what we're going to do special today, I know it's usually a local news and alternative views show, but one of the things that people try to do in the summer is to read a little bit. And it's usually not a heavy-duty school-type classic fiction, even though it should be, perhaps because that's proven its worth, folks, for hundreds of years. We're going to have an interview in just a few minutes with a internationally known writer of thriller novels, a New York Times best-selling author, in fact. His name, James Rollins, and his newest thriller novel is called The Devil Colony, and it's part of a series that talks about a fictional United States force, sort of, I think he calls them spies, soldiers, and scientists all in one, the Sigma Force series, and this is the fifth or the sixth in that series, The Devil Colony, and we'll have him talking about that, as well as, well, what is a thriller novel? I did finish The Devil Colony myself, finished reading it in the last week, and I was much impressed, and here I am, an old-time English teacher, read all those classic novels and artistic works of literature, and I was impressed and had a lot of fun reading it. So we're going to talk about thriller novels in general and not just push Devil Colony on you as some sort of commercial. So maybe you'd want to read a thriller novel sometime this summer, just for entertainment. And maybe it'll stimulate your thinking about something, too. In the second half of the show, we hope to get an interview, a call in from a French director who lives in this country. Her name is Céline Danier, and she is the director of the documentary, feature-length documentary, Blank City, which is going to be premiering in Detroit area at the Detroit Institute of Arts, Detroit Film Theater, this weekend, tonight, tomorrow, Sunday. So it might be something to do. And it's also going to be around a week from Sunday, also at the Detroit Film Theater. And so we're going to interview her. It's all about, that documentary is all about New York City and the art that was going on then, the artists that were working in film, music, theater, performance. Pretty challenging stuff, pretty amazing things. A lot of it did not get much national attention, but it is an important historic point in time. The Detroit connection is Patti Smith and the so-called punk music movement that was going on in New York City at that time. Patti Smith was there. Of course, she was Detroit native, and she's been back living in Detroit. I don't know where she's living these days, but she now has started her career up again as of the last 5-6 years ago and is still out there performing. So that's the Detroit connection on that. A couple things there. Thriller novels, just think you ought to have some ideas and some choices. So, phone call coming in right now. Excuse me. Hello, this is WHFR Radio. Jay speaking. Hi. Hey, Jim. I'm on the air now, and we're going to put you live in just a second. Do I have your attention, for the next 25 minutes or so? Okay, we're going to talk about thriller novels, and of course, Devil's Colony. So just hang on, and we'll be talking. Hang on. James Rollins on the phone, and we're going to connect with him right now. Hi, Mr. Rollins. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the program.
Oh, you're very welcome. I was very impressed with your latest novel, I read it in the last week, The Devil Colony, and it's just been out, available for, a couple weeks now, I guess?
It's about a week.
Yeah, and hope it's doing well. I had really no connection with thrillers in my life because, I've been a college professor of English language literature, and we don't often get involved with so-called popular entertainment, the genre work of, say, science fiction, murder mystery detective, fantasy, and so on. I have tried to read a little bit of J.K. Rowling's, the Harry Potter stuff and the vampire stuff of Anne Rice, and I didn't care for that much. In terms of science fiction, I like the so-called hard science fiction based on, science that we know now and just sort of extrapolated from that. But a lot of science fiction is going into fantasy now. Anyway, I was not aware of what has become now, and thanks to you, I think, the thriller genre. So let's just start, back at the beginning. How did you become a writer? Just one bit of background that I know is that you actually went all the way through school, got your doctorate in veterinary medicine, and you were a veterinarian at the beginning. So how did you make the transition to big-time novelist?
Well, I always wanted to be a veterinarian. I remember from third grade I got that essay assignment that all third-grade teachers give you, which is what do you want to be when you grow up, and mm-hmm. It was a point of moral dilemma for the third-grade version of myself. I remember sitting at my desk going, I want to write veterinarian, but I just don't know how to spell it. And I did the one thing all third graders hate to do. I actually got the dictionary and looked it up. Ooh. So from third grade, I knew I wanted to be a veterinarian. But there was also, that's like the right side of my brain, but there's another side of my brain that was basically the storyteller of the family. I had I've got three brothers and three sisters, and they were my early audience, or in this case, maybe the early victims. I was always trying to find ways of terrorizing them and telling them, twisted, strange stories and seeing what they get them to believe. And, I call it storytelling. My mom called it lying. But there's that side of my personality that I always wanted to spin and tell these stories. And I always thought that to be a published author, you had to fall off some type of literary apple tree, be the great-grandson of Fitzgerald or, I thought, well, the career path towards veterinarian is something that I can understand, and pursued that, and then started dabbling with writing on the side as a hobby.
Mm-hmm.
Wrote a bunch of short fiction that's now safely buried in my backyard. I'll never see the light of day.
Okay.
That's my first novel, and was lucky enough to see my first novel sell.
Yeah, that's a fascinating story. So when that sold, you were already a practicing veterinarian, though.
Right. I had my own clinic. I've been practicing at that point for about 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
I slowly made a transition by from writing full-time, I mean, from being a veterinarian full-time to writing full-time.
Well, that's an amazing story, but I certainly know as an educator myself that people, as they grow older, as they continue to be alive, you need to keep exploring what your talents might be, you know, because, you know, you follow what you're good at, but also what your enthusiasm leads you to also. And these days, you practically have to, you know, follow career paths and situations as they present themselves, as the opportunity comes up. Did you ever have literature classes in college that might have stimulated you somewhat, or were they all just classic?
I took a creative writing class in my undergraduate years,
mm-hmm.
and I enjoyed that thoroughly.
Mm-hmm.
And I just sort of kept, and I continued to read, and that was like throwing gasoline on that little twisted corner of my mind from childhood
mm-hmm.
that made me want to keep attempting to write. And then afterwards, I just sort of self-taught through taking online classes and through...
Wow, online, okay.
Reading. You know, the old adage, write every day, but I also like to add the caveat, you should be reading every night. You know, I think a good book or even a bad book is sometimes the best teacher of the craft, is that whatever trouble you're having with it during your daytime, whether mm-hmm. it's doing dialogue or how to present a character or describe a character when they first walk onto set, oftentimes the book you're reading that evening, you have an example of how they're doing that from another author. And so mm-hmm. I think by writing every day and reading every night, your prose will get stronger and stronger.
Yeah, you obviously from your bio that I'm looking at here, somewhere in your youth, as you were growing up, you had read the usual sort of adventure novels. It looks like Tarzan, the Wizard of Oz series, C.S. Lewis, Jules Verne, H.G. Wells. Those are pretty well known and exciting, great works of literature. Were you involved at all, or were you moved at all by movies in those genres?
I definitely like movies. I'm a bit of a movie junkie. I can't say that I don't still enjoy them today.
Mm-hmm.
But I also was moved by a lot of there's an old dime store pulp novels from the 30s and 40s, like Doc Savage, The Shadow, The Avenger. I still have on my bookshelf here in my library 181 Doc Savage novels.
Wow.
And old dime store novels, which are a mixture of blend of, you know, wild adventure along with, you know, weird science or weird history. Definitely, I think, affected me, and for all intents and purposes, I think I'm just doing like a modern polish on those old dime store novels from the 30s and 40s, you know, wild adventures, weird science, and some strange mm-hmm. history.
I guess you would say to someone that asks you, how do you get into writing, you have to do a lot of reading at the beginning, even, to become familiar with all the different approaches and just expand your vocabulary and view of the world. I didn't feel that I had really adequately read books and had a context until I think I was finished with my first master's degree. And I said, whoa, all of a sudden it's coming together. I can see how, you know, literature is I could see the big picture of it, in other words, a little bit better. But that was, who knows, that might have been thousands of novels and short stories.
I think it's important that you read, especially if you're going to be writing into a genre like you're mentioning, whether it's science fiction, fantasy, horror, or whatever, that you read deeply into that genre so you recognize the tropes that have been well trodden in and trying to cast those in a new spin, if at all possible. And I read a wide gamut of different things. I also try to read the Pulitzer every year. I think one of the books that was most influential for taking me from that short fiction that's buried in my backyard to published author was The Shipping News by Yanni, I can't pronounce her last name.
Prue, yes.
Mm-hmm. And just what she did with language was, she was just such an acrobat. And with both sentence structure and language, it sort of freed something inside me. I remember reading that novel and going, wow, I'm going to try that with my next short story. Just sort of unfettering myself a bit from what I considered to be the convention, and I think was making my writing a bit stilted. And so it was greatly influential. Mm-hmm.
Here on WHFR today, we're talking in our first half hour with James Rollins. That's R-O-L-L-I-N-S. You can find out more about his work and all of his novels at jamesrollins.com. Well, we're going to talk a little specifically about The Devil Colony in just a second, but maybe a few words about reading. A lot of people going through school, they don't read as much, at least going through high school, as I know I did. Even in college, it doesn't seem they assign as many books. So our interest or skills at reading seem to be somewhat declining, I'm sorry to say. So certainly and I know you, would have to advocate for the very, very special experience that reading is. And so how would you tell people that haven't read much, not about your own things, but what is the joy of reading, do you think, briefly?
Well, there's no experience, I think, compared to reading. I mean, we watch a movie, it's a decent experience, but it's not as immersive and fully enveloping as reading is. I belong to the International Thriller Writers. I was one of the founding board members to that group. And we work closely in ties with Reading as Fundamental, which is a great organization that's, again, trying to stimulate literacy and reading in general. Because it's, there's a lot of distractions in life between the internet and movies and televisions and video games. And they're very short little bursts of stimulation, whereas reading is a much more immersive. It's a longer event, and I think it's much more enriching. You know, kids that read do better in test scores, do better in life in general. It basically is a way of molding that, or not molding mind, but creating a more malleable mind, a mind that's actually able to absorb knowledge in general better. By stimulating and working that reading muscle.
I would have to add that it's interactive. A lot of people would say, well, it's not. You just read the words on the page. But in fact, you're taking those words, which are not pictures, and you're creating pictures and actions and imagining the setting in your mind. So you're really, good reading is an active experience, even sort of critical thinking, which I really loved Devil Colony, especially because it made me think and try to connect things. And amazingly, things that I read a lot of nonfiction about science and technology, and you got it right on. Those elements that you brought into Devil Colony, it was just so exciting to see what you did with those things. Obviously, every good writer manipulates and extrapolates from some basic facts, but it really got me thinking and trying to work things out, and not just the plot of the story, which was great by itself, but, you know, so I'm just saying that a good book really is going to make you think and create the setting, but also consider ideas at length. I read pretty fast. I think I read Devil Colony in about 8 hours, but spread over several days, but it's still... In fact, I like to read with a pen in hand because I like to underline things and really focus on the big ideas and turn the pages back and forth. What do you think about e-books? Of course, Devil Colony is available as an e-book in the several different formats, I assume, Kindle, Amazon, which is from Amazon, and Apple's iBooks, and for the Nook from Barnes & Noble. To me, that's a alien experience, but that's just because so many decades of reading print novels. But
yeah, I'm probably a bit of a Luddite in that aspect too. I don't own a Kindle or a Nook. I still prefer the physicality of a book. Like you said, I often do have a pen handy. So whether I'm reading nonfiction or fiction, whether it's fiction, if it's a catch a phrase, the way somebody does something, I'll mark it in the book. Whether it's nonfiction, I'll be notating. Mm-hmm. You mentioned about reading being interactive and a different experience. There was a study that was done, and I think it's just a fascinating study, comparing how many calories are burned doing what activity. You actually burn more calories reading over an hour than you do watching television over an hour. Mm. That tells you there's something going on between reader and book
that's
beyond, that's something more significant, whether it's your heart's beating faster because you're involved in the story, whether it's your brain's working harder, burning more energy. But that just indicates that it is not a passive event, that there is actually more calories burning than sitting passively.
Yeah, I don't like e-books myself because I read so fast, I have to keep hitting forward to turn the page, whereas a print book actually has more words per page. The smaller screens of even like the Kindle or Well, my iPod even, oh my gosh, you know, I just burn through there and it wears out my finger trying to keep pushing the button every 10 seconds. So
I'm just wondering, though, if, you know, this is the newest generation that is sort of, you know, hooked up to the internet, hooked up to computers much more intimately than I was raised, whether that is not a media to get them reading. We mentioned about trying to get more kids reading, that is not a vehicle to do that by having that instantaneous between when they were listening to the music, they can hit a button, and now they're reading that novel, they can hit that button, they can jump to the internet to research some aspect of that novel and back to the novel. Yep. They do seem to be very good at multitasking, more so than probably the way I've been raised and wired.
One thing I discovered about e-books is that you can get like a Kindle subscription for your Mac or Windows, and you don't have to buy anything necessarily. Right. They actually can give you as much as the first chapter to read. So it's and now that we don't have so many bookstores, I mean, in our area, most of the Borders bookstores, which is a big national chain, have closed, and Barnes and Noble is hanging on, but they don't have as the really big selection if you really want to dig for all kinds of things.
Right.
And libraries are not doing so well, have a lot of closed hours these days, closed days, in fact, as well as limited hours. So ebook might be a great way to get into things. I have to say, I read the sort of a prequel short story to Devil Colony through my Kindle subscription for no charge, and that got me into the plot and some of the characters, and so it did sort of get my make that connection. But then I had to go to the book, and oh my gosh, I love the turning pages and the depth of that. Briefly, we're going to finish up with Devil Colony in our last few minutes, but International Thriller Writers, that's an organization that you and others put together. What is the thriller genre? Can you really define it? It's just a lot of action. I mean, things are always happening. There's always plot twists. I mean, that's a lot of fun, and it's interesting because it's all tied together so well, at least in your work. How would you define it?
When we first were putting an organization together, we had to define what is a thriller, and it was a challenge, actually.
Yeah.
And there was many fierce arguments about how to define that, and the definition became very long and involved, and people had different opinions on exactly what classified, because it's a big umbrella. I mean, science fiction, some science fiction that's very made to get the heart pumping, and that could be classified as a thriller. There's mysteries that are thrillers. There's a romantic suspense that could be classified as a thriller. So it's a pretty big umbrella.
Mm-hmm. Well, but it has to be thrilling ultimately, right?
Well, we basically got created because we were always sort of the ugly stepchild of the Mystery Writers Association. But we weren't doing the classic whodunit type of mysteries, and they didn't quite know what to do with us, and so we were always made to sit at the kids' table at these conventions, and eventually we thought, we're not writing mysteries, but if it quacks like a duck and swims like a duck and is feathered like a duck, we know it's that duck. So we sort of recognize what a thriller when we read it, though sometimes it's hard to classify the entire genre under a few words.
Sure. Well, the organization is International Thriller Writers, and if you want more information about that, thrillerwriters.org, folks. It's mainly people who are, people who get in free. They're actually people who are published writers of in the thriller genre or genres, as the case may be, and they do a lot of good deeds, a lot of public work. I know there's grants to writers. You've got a writers' conference coming up next week in New York City, right?
Yeah, but part of that's Craft Fest, where we have a whole day where we have different programs on aspects of writing, and in fact, this year we have Ken Follett will be teaching one of our courses.
Yeah, it's not inexpensive experience, but it's high level craft conference on thriller writing, and it's in New York City. And it's probably could still register if they had the money and time. But it's
you can register on the spot, and you can do it just for one day or all the days of the conference. And the one day isn't too bad price wise if you're just doing the one day.
Yeah.
Of course, you got to get to New York.
Yeah, you got to get to New York from Detroit. But it's July 6th through 9th. But I just think people that I signed up for the email from ITW, not to join as a member, just to find out, you know, some of the latest novels coming out from some of your members. And that's help me choose my books in the future. We're talking here on the Journal for the first half hour today with James Rollins, who is a best-selling author of thrillers. Actually, you have another pen name, James Clemens, too, where and under that name you do fantasy novels, right?
When I was selling my first thriller, I collected a lot of rejection letters. I actually got rejected by 49 different agents before my 50th agent. I'm not even exaggerating. It was 5-0. The 50th agent represented that book. But it's a long process even to get to that stage, and I sort of became convinced maybe I'm not a thriller writer. And I jumped to another genre that I love to read, which is fantasy, and started writing, working on that novel. And sort of lo and behold, within about 6 weeks, through totally different avenues, I ended up with two different publishing houses under two different genres. I all of a sudden had two different names.
Sure, and just so people wouldn't be confused if they saw the name on the book stand and they said, oh, it's going to be a thriller, or this is going to be fantasy, and whoops, nope, you were switching genres on them, and they hadn't noticed. So
publishing houses like to pigeonhole you. They need to know sort of where they want to sell you in a bookstore and what shelf to put you on, that Borders or that Barnes & Noble's. The independent bookstore.
Who suggested you actually use a name other than your birth name?
Well, my real last name is Czajkowski, and the first four letters of that of that name is C-Z-A-J. And by that point, everybody gets lost. Even on my front door of my veterinary clinic, it was Dr. Jim, in quotes, Czajkowski, because everybody just didn't want to try to even attempt that last name. So when I was selling
Dr. Jim,
both publishing houses independently said, you know, we like the book, but that name's got to go.
Yeah, well, that's the price of fame and glory, I guess, huh? Okay, Devil Colony. What makes it so special? In fact, is this the fifth or the sixth in the series about the fictional Sigma Force?
It's the seventh.
Okay, the seventh. So these characters, or most of them anyway, have been ongoing for, since about 2004, 2005?
Right.
And this one took you 2 years to write.
It did.
Why so long? I mean, I know some famous authors might have, 10, 20 years to write a novel, but most thriller writers, maybe because of the formula or the... just the way things go, you want to keep the action going, and you can write them a little bit faster. But this one, there's an awful lot going on in it, many different details, tremendous research. That's what I'm amazed of, how much is nonfiction that you try to tie together for the sake of your fictional story. So was that what it was?
This book took a lot more research, and it was tackling some controversial and touchy subject matter, and I wanted to make sure before I tackle this novel that I had every I dotted and T crossed before I jumped into such a story. So this one took a bit more research than it normally involves, a bit more care in writing, and then some follow-up to make sure I had all my details correct.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a bit more of a lengthy process.
I just made a brief list just from the top of my head here. You deal with the Book of Mormon, Mormonism, nanotechnology, lost tribes of Israel, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and sort of an end-of-the-world connection that is the supervolcano that is actually building under Yellowstone, which... I assume that the delicate part, of course, the science part you want to have right, but the delicate part was how do you deal with Mormonism, in a way that's respectful and yet revealing information that people didn't know about it?
Yeah, because basically the whole book started from that point. I had two friends at a dinner party, two friends that are Mormon, started a civil discussion about one aspect of the Book of Mormon, became more and more heated until eventually I thought they were going to break out the boxing gloves. and it was basically a controversial and somewhat a point of the Book of Mormon that they got to catch a lot of flack from, and that's, according to the Book of Mormon, the Native American tribes of North America are said to be descendants out of a lost tribe out of Israel.
Mm.
You know, on face value, that's pretty crazy. Genetics don't seem to support it, and so I thought, well, but as heated as these gentlemen are about this topic, maybe there's something here.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent that almost a year long doing research into Native American history, into ancient Jewish lore, into the founding of this country, and these pieces began to fall together almost like a jigsaw puzzle and presented basically a different, well, not even, I shouldn't say different, I think actually a truer version of early America and the founding of this country, because there's a whole whitewashed bit of history about the founding of this country that anybody that reads my book can go and Google it or check it. At the end of my book, I sort of lay out what's true and what's not so they can follow their own footsteps from there.
Yeah.
and they can research and find out there actually is a huge part of American history in the founding of this country that's been whitewashed away, whether it's racism because it deals with the Native American tribes and their interaction with the early colonies.
Right.
And how influential that Native American culture was to the founding of this country. We sort of whitewashed that away, but in this book I clean that whitewash off and sort of expose that again.
And the title, The Devil Colony, is that just a reference by people that didn't understand it? Because it was basically a reference to a Native American
colony,
if you will. Yeah.
Thomas Jefferson was, he was a bit of a conundrum. He was fascinated to the point of fixation with American Indians, with the Native Americans around there. Hmm. He accumulated a vast collection of artifacts and built a mini museum, a museum actually that probably rivaled the museums of his time. And just one sort of intriguing mystery about that on a side note is that when Jefferson died, that entire collection vanished.
Yeah.
Historians to this day are trying to still piece together where those artifacts went to and why they were dispersed. Of course, as a thriller writer, I have my own theory.
Sure.
But this fixation with the Indians went to the point where there was some talk back in the early times of potentially having a 14th colony to the U.S. You know, we all know the 13th colony, but this is potentially a 14th colony, and Jefferson was in early negotiations and considering adopting the Iroquois Nation, which is a group of six warring Indian tribes that banded together as one about 200 years before the founding of this country, and they occupied the territory between Canada and pretty much just west of the 13 colonies.
To give them their own state, if you will, or province.
State,
yeah,
exactly.
Right.
No, of course, that never happened.
No.
And again, as a thriller writer, I have my own theory on why that didn't happen, and that's where the story sort of jumps off.
Just one last fact, and then we've got to say goodbye to you, and wish you a happy July 4th. In honor of the July 4th, the Iroquois Confederacy, didn't they have a document that actually was pretty much, as you mentioned, the novel, pretty much taken, at least the opening? Is it the preamble to the Constitution, or is it the Declaration of Independence? Which
The preamble of the Constitution.
Right.
The Iroquois had their own constitution. It was called the Law of Peace. It was their foundation for their form of government, which was a democratic representative form of government. Women were involved in the government.
Right.
And so they had it all worked out, basically, and this was shared with the colonists.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, at the Constitutional Convention where they were formulating the Constitution, the South Carolina delegate from stood up and read from the opening of that Iroquois Constitution, and the word started with, "We the people establish a union for peace, equity, and order," which was pretty much lifted almost verbatim and became the preamble to our own Constitution.
That's so
many
exciting.
People aren't aware of that, that type of connection. It goes a lot deeper than that. I barely scratched the surface here, but the book goes into great more detail about how intimate that relationship was between the Iroquois Constitution and our own founding documents.
Well, I certainly wish you well with all of your books. I know you also have a sort of action adventure series for young people that you work on and go from fantasy to the Sigma Force back to that. So we wish you well with all of that, especially The Devil Colony. It's a book that I enjoyed very much And I thank you for being on the WHFR Journal today to explain about thrillers and thriller writing. I think it'll give people some very valuable chance to get into reading and get some good entertainment this summer.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for being with us on the Journal. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
And this is the new WHFR Journal. That was James Rollins, R-O-L-L-I-N-S. We're waiting for a call. In fact, I saw the light flashing here. No one else to take the call, but I suspect that maybe our documentary film director, Céline Donnier, was trying to get in touch. So since she has my number, I don't have hers. We're going to go to a commentary by Jim Hightower right now, and we'll wait for that second call. And as soon as it comes in, we'll start that interview about the documentary Blank City that's going to be at the Detroit Institute of Arts this weekend and once next weekend too. So listen to Jim Hightower's comment, and we'll be continuing with our interviews today on the special entertainment version of the Journal.
Will Rogers said that when Congress comes into session, the public gets the same panicky feeling as when the baby gets hold of a hammer. Rogers' observation can also be applied to the mayhem that has broken out in various smash-happy state legislatures. All across the country, right-wing zealots are wielding their little ideological hammers to destroy common sense and wreck the common good. These anti-government extremists are going after everything from the basic rights of workers to our crucial environmental protections. Their most shameful assault, however, is on our public schools. They're not merely clobbering teachers and shattering education budgets. They're after the very idea of public education. A few years ago, Debbie Riddle, a boneheaded Texas legislator, asked, "Where did this idea come from that everybody deserves free education?" "It comes from Moscow, from Russia. It comes straight out of the pit of hell," she sputtered. She was hooted down then, but this year, her Kafkaesque ideological extremism has moved from the legislative fringe to the center of the Republican majority's agenda. Using the huge budget deficit, which they created, as their excuse, Texas GOP lawmakers and the GOP governor are cavalierly abrogating our state's historic constitutional commitment to providing, quote, an efficient system of public free schools. Even as student enrollment is growing exponentially, these ideologues are whacking the state school budget by $4 billion. Worse, they're terminating the law that gives our public schools top budgetary priority based on how much we need to spend to educate our children. No more entitlement, they scream, as stupidly as they can. This is Jim Hightower saying, unfortunately, Texas is not the only state putting budgetary ideology over school kids, undermining our entire society's future. As the old bumper sticker puts it, if you think education is expensive, try ignorance.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
We're back with the new WHFR Journal, and we have on the line from New York City, Celine Dinier, director of Blank City, the new documentary. It's going to be this weekend at the DIA. Hi, Celine. How are you?
Hello.
Or should I say ça va?
Ça va, ça va.
Okay. Ça va bien pour moi. Anyway.
Ça va très bien. I'm very happy, you know, to show Blank City in Detroit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tell us, first of all, a little bit about your background. I have a lot of information, and I did get a chance to see the special screener, as they call them, of Blank City last night. So I've got the lead on my audience, who will probably have to wait for this weekend. And as a former film history professor, I retired a few years ago, but I taught several classes on the American independent cinema, which got sort of a rebirth exactly at the time and in New York City that your documentary covers. So I know how really good and, in fact, in-depth this documentary is. I can actually say that because of my experience. So I hope a lot of people who are already into films and or into, let's say, avant art or even punk music from the 70s and 80s, I hope they can get to see this. But first, tell us about yourself. This is your first film, and I think this is amazing. What's your background? I know you're from France. Did you study filmmaking in a French school?
No, not at all. My background is kind of different because I went to law school for a while.
Law school, okay.
And I was living in France, and I knew this label, No Wave, for the music, but not really for films. And it was like a few years ago during retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art in Paris, I discovered some of the film, you know, from like No Wave. It was the movies of Kampner from 78 and Eric Mitchell.
Right. Uh-huh.
And I was very impressed because I really knew like No Wave for music but not for film. So I started to make some research. It was very, very difficult to find a lot of information, and I knew that Jim Jarmusch, I knew like the movies of Jim Jarmusch, of Charlie Hayer, mm-hmm. Susan Sidelman, but I did not know that they were part of this like No Wave movement.
Right.
So it was like the starting point, so I decided, you know, to, with my producers, Aviva Wishnow and Vanessa Roworth, we decided, you know, to work on a documentary about this moment in New York.
Right.
You know, when New York was almost, you know, like bankrupt and very bombed out. And it was a very cinematic backdrop. And
really, yes.
This sense of anarchy, you know, which allowed people to shoot everywhere, anytime, and with anyone.
Okay, let me recap for our audience. First of all, you've mentioned the name of Jim Jarmusch, and I think some other people would know of Deborah Harry, who is part of Blondie, and Patti Smith, because she actually was born and started in Detroit and then moved to New York to be part of that art movement. So there are many elements that people may be aware of. Steve Buscemi, who is now starring in, of course, some Hollywood movies, but also is the star of an HBO cable series called Empire. I think many of our listeners who, you know, don't know about these sort of avant artists from the 70s and 80s could make a connection that way. So you started researching in Paris, and your background is that of being a lawyer or having studied for the law. How did you get over to New York and begin making a documentary?
It's funny because I kept the same kind of spirit, do-it-yourself and this DIY like attitude. So I moved to New York. It was like almost like 3 years and a half ago, 4 years ago, and self documentary with no connection. But we had this feeling that, you know, like no one, you know, didn't do any kind of documentary like that about, you know, this like film movement. So we started to track down some of the people, and I started to contact, you know, some of the people, you know, it was great because almost everybody said yes.
Well, you've assembled, I spent the time to watch the credits at the end of the movie, an amazing team of researchers, so many film clips from short films and long films, many of which have never been shown nationally in the United States even, still photographs from personal and library, Super 8 film. Amazing job of editing. So you certainly had help from a large team, and you'd never done this sort of coordination before?
No. But it's what was amazing. It's people were like very like willing to share the materials or like the stories. Mm-hmm. So this sense of like community. Even if New York now it's a very like different like landscape, it's still, you know, was still, you know, happening. So for like the films that we find, it was a lot, you know, we had to deal a lot with like the filmmakers themselves, and otherwise we met, you know, with some like people we had some personal collection, or the NYU said library, or even the Anthology Film Archive, you know, help us.
Well, it's just an amazing collaboration that you were in charge of, I guess. And I can understand that a lot of these people, a lot of the filmmakers and artists, they were perhaps happy to be able to tell their story and make all these connections, which is not just among film, but also the whole art scene of the day. That sort of comprehensive, picture is very, very helpful for understanding what was going on. And you had to travel, or at least had teams that did interviews in Los Angeles, and I think Melbourne, Australia, even, and amazing. And so you've been working on this since you came to this country in 2004. It was a sort of a work in progress.
2006.
And it's been in many festivals, shown. Tribeca was a work in progress, I guess, back in 2009. And then the official release was either last year or this year. I see dates of 2010 or 2011, which doesn't...
We showed like the film at the Berlin Film Festival.
Mm-hmm. Berlin,
and
yep.
And then we like the release of Blank City was like April 6th, you know, in New York we started. Mm-hmm.
Well, you'd already received very, very complimentary review from the New York Times back in April of this year, April 5th. I have it in front of me. Their number one reviewer, A.O. Scott, did it. And it's really, 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 I can understand why Elliot Wilhelm chose it for the Detroit Film Theater for this weekend. Remind our folks, we're talking to director Céline Danier, who directed the documentary, feature-length documentary, Blank City, which will be tonight and tomorrow night at 7 p.m. At the Detroit Film Theater at the Detroit Institute of Arts, and 2 p.m. Sunday, and again next week Sunday, I understand, at 4:30. Will you be coming into town to be there at all, or...
No, not this weekend, but perhaps, you know, because I think, you know, like going to Detroit and showing the film in Detroit will be very, very, it's a very interesting place for me right now, Detroit.
Yes.
And what is funny, it's a lot of people after like watching Blank City, a lot of people are telling me that Detroit is like, how was New York, you know, back to this, you know, this time, so... Perhaps next week I'm going to try, but I'm not sure.
Well, that I just sometimes they do. Certainly, you're invited to show up if you'd like to. I know that Detroit and Detroit artists are, Detroit is not doing well as a city. Not many people left from the heyday, and not many jobs. And but there is a solid group of artists who are struggling to, you know, to continue their own work and to find a new purpose. So who knows what might result from that? Maybe like the 70s or 80s in New York. It's also going, I see, I go to Austin, Texas frequently for the South by Southwest Film Festival and the Austin Film Fest, which is a different one they have in the fall. And your film is next going to be showed at the Alamo Draft House. Have you ever been to Austin or been at the Alamo Draft House before?
No, never.
It's really a fun, well, Austin is a great city, but it's the Draft House actually does seat you so you can order and be served a meal and alcoholic beverages right when you're watching the movie. Now I've only been to France a couple of times, and I did go to one theater in I think it was Deauville where you actually could order food and beverages and eat right in your seat, you know, right at the theater there. But the Draft House is unique in this country, and it's in Austin, and they have a lot of good film goers, I'm sure, both in Detroit and in Austin. You should have a lot of people attending to see this film. It's obviously it's already been extremely well reviewed. Let's just finish up by asking you, where did the title Blank City come from? Obviously, there was so much going on in New York, always is. How can you call it Blank City?
Because first, like you can have like two kind of explanations. The first one is, you know, late 70s. You know, late 70s, New York was very bombed out. And it was for a lot of people, they came to New York and it was like New York was like a blank canvas. You just had the feeling to fill, you know, this canvas. So this is the title, this, Blank City, because New York was blank at that time. And as well, you know, it can be, you can find a connection with Blank Generation from Amos Poe, because Blank Generation was one of the first movies, you know, from this movement.
Yes. Yes, Blank Generation by Amos Poe. And, of course, you interview him and you show clips from that film. Blank, sort of like an open space, an empty space, like a vacuum. And, of course, things will flow into it. And so it sort of causes things to happen. So I can understand that. But somebody said, well, Blank City, I don't know if I want to see that movie. It's not about anything. No, it's about a lot of stuff, folks. And I do think it's probably not for young children. There are some clips of the film. One of the movements that you include, the cinema of transgression, Those clips are a little violent, a little bit strange for young children, but for adults that really want to understand or think about what is art and what happened in those two decades in New York, I think it's a brilliant piece of cinema, almost historic. Dare I ask, what can you do next? Are you going to continue to make another film on something?
Yes. Yes, like I'm working right now on different like projects. So yes, next it's like, you know, sometimes when you have like an idea, you have like different kind of medium to express this idea.
Right.
So you know, we just had this release of Blank City like a few months ago. So now I'm like working on a new project.
Well, great. Great. And you certainly have pulled this very complex but very, very important topic together so well. I assume you already have an agreement for a CD release?
A DVD release.
Yes, a DVD, yes.
Yes, a DVD. We're going to have like the DVD of Blank City probably, you know, in fall.
In the fall. Okay. Well, I'll be looking forward to that, certainly since it's kind of my area of the specialty of teaching, you know, the American independent film in that period of time. I certainly want to have that copy for my own personal library, and I think it's going to sell well for many, many, many years just because it's so important, and you've got some really wonderful interviews and clips there that I don't think we can see anywhere else. So good luck to you. Thank you so
thank
much
you.
For doing the interview with us today on the new WHFR Journal.
No, thank you very much. And yes, like people, like it's Blank City, it's a documentary for like a lot of, you know, people interested in, you know, in art.
Yes.
So I really think that Blank City will bring like more attention to this time in New York where energy and creativity had no boundaries.
I certainly hope so too. And maybe it'll happen in Detroit and help us out here someday. Thank you so much. Good luck to you in the future. And
thank you.
Goodbye for now. Have a good weekend.
Thank you. Have a nice weekend. Bye-bye.
That was Céline Danier, who has the film Blank City that will debut in Detroit at the Detroit Film Theater, which is located in the Detroit Institute of Arts, 7 p.m. this evening, 7 p.m. Tomorrow night, and 2 p.m. on Sunday. I don't know if they're having a second feature. Might be a different film. You might want to go to the DIA.org website and find out what the second film is. The film is about an hour and a half long, so if it does start at 7 tonight, you'll be out of there by 8:30 if you have other things to do. Again, not recommended for children, but for people into film and movies and art, and especially avant-garde art, punk music, the history of that back in the 70s and 80s in New York. This film is exceptional. She mentioned two terms. I mentioned cinema of transgression, which is kind of an awful, in-your-face, sadist, masochistic kind of expression, which you know, some people may have difficulty placing. That's only a small part of the whole story, though. She first mentioned, and I didn't emphasize it, that this group was, the filmmakers were called the No Wave Group. And that was because in the beginning in the 60s, French filmmakers in Paris were referred to as the New Wave. Okay. It's François Truffaut, Jean-Luc Godard, and especially Godard was a big hero to a lot of these same independent American filmmakers in the 70s and the 80s, even though he didn't have too much commercial success in the United States. Well, really, no major commercial success. So they had to call themselves something different, even though they had a lot of respect for Jean-Luc Godard. And so they call themselves, or others call them, the No Wave Movement. And many of them, even in the films, say, well, you got to call it something, so why not, you know? And it's just very exciting film for those who are into films and into history and music, art, theater. So spread the word among that circle of friends. I wanted to read today in our special It's our special summer entertainment edition of the new WHFR Journal on the 4th of July weekend. Perhaps read the Declaration of Independence itself. Well, another phone call coming in, so it was we play by the, you know, fast and loose here. So hang on, I'm going to take it. Hi, it's the WHFR, Jay speaking. Yeah. Yes. Okay. All right. No problem. I'm here. I hope so. Sure. Maybe. I'll try. Sure. Bye. You see? You see? It is live radio, folks. That's Joanne Kay, our Highway 61 Blues DJ, who says that I can keep talking for a while. She's just leaving her home in West Dearborn right now. So, no, she didn't say I could keep talking. Nope, I got to get the blues started for her in 7 minutes. You know, we have extra copies here at the station, just for the staff that I brought in of the Declaration of Independence. Wouldn't hurt this weekend for you to actually try to find a copy. I'm sure it's on the internet somewhere, and read it out loud. I can't think of a better tribute to this vital document. You know, it happened before the Constitution, but it really was our statement that we are not going to put up with British rule and domination and tyranny any longer. And if you don't remember the words, I'm going to read the first three paragraphs. Okay, here we go. In Congress, July 4th, 1776, the unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America. When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable, than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government, and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of England, King of Great Britain, is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. And there is a list of, I'd say, 20 or 30 individuals, specific problems that the 13 colonies had with England. And they conclude, we therefore, the representatives of the United States of America in General Congress, assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved. and that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge each other to our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. The major name, the largest name that's signed to it, of course, is that of John Hancock. So when they say, hey, put your John Hancock on this, does anybody say that anymore? They're talking about, of course, the big time signature, the bigger signature at the end of the Declaration of Independence by John Hancock. And of course, many of our founding fathers were part of this and signed their names, Benjamin Franklin, Samuel Adams, John Adams, it's an amazing, important document. I'd also like to say, as a history buff myself, remember that the American Revolution was a minority revolution. That's right. The majority of people in the United States did not want to separate from England. They wanted to put up with all the taxation and all the lack of representation. But that's always been the case, that a strong and organized minority, and in this case, let's not forget, a militant minority, who would have been called terrorist in their day if they used that, if the British used that term. In fact, they didn't even fight fairly. You know, our American Revolutionary militias, they hid behind trees and shot at the British who were standing out in the field in the open in their red coats. Not too fair. Okay. But if you want to win a battle, you know, the rules of war are unfortunately whoever wins. And I'm never in favor of war, folks, or killing. But that's the simple fact, is that a very intelligent, smart, and organized group that knew where it was going, knew what their goals were going to be, and that they'd form a new government that was better, and have peace and order guaranteed after this break. And that's always the problem. There have been a lot of revolutions, but things haven't gone well after most revolutions. And we're amazingly lucky that we had the quality of people we did behind the revolution, our so-called forefathers, more than four, of course. And, well, it's just a very important day, and hopefully it should be celebrated for what it was, and that was further guarantee and establish, really, the freedoms that we hope all people can enjoy someday. So I hope you all have a great holiday weekend, and hope you enjoyed our special edition of the new WHFR Journal Summer Entertainment Special. Our guests were, of course, James Rollins, author of The Devil Colony, and director Céline Danier, who is the director of Blank City, debuting this weekend at the Detroit Institute of Arts. Hope we've given you some ideas for summer entertainment. Be careful on the roads and be good to each other. And we'll be back next Friday with another edition of the new WHFR Journal. This is WHFR Dearborn, WHFR.fm, the station making waves.
Stay.